Good evening, everyone. You're listening to CITR Radio at 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory. Thank you for tuning into today's episode of Intersections, CITR's biweekly radio show about feminism, gender empowerment, and bringing down the patriarchy. All of which, in our day's work for the small but powerful team here at CITR, we air every other Tuesday from 4 to 5 p.m., so make sure you tune in then for some woke conversations and content. Now, for those of you who've been living under a rock for the past month, and justifiably so, what with essays and midterms and various other academic devices of torture, it's Black History Month, and Intersections is finally doing a long-awaited segment on Black history and Black excellence. And we have very special guests in the studio with us right now to join in on that conversation. We have Brendan Barnes from UBC's Black Student Union. And we were supposed to have Sydney Henry as well, but she's running a little bit late and she's going to join us hopefully in the next 10 minutes or so. And of course, we have the one and only Sandra. And Sandra, I'm going to butcher this. Sandra Irogbu?
Close enough.
Guys, thank you so much for being here.
Honestly, thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for having me as well.
And we also have Danielle, of course, and Chimji for the first time. Chimji joining us. Yeah. All right, guys. So I guess like jumping right into it, what does Black History Month mean to you guys? Do you feel like this is something that I was thinking about a lot when I was kind of, you know, thinking about this panel today? Do you feel like there's a certain element of tokenism that's maybe become a part of Black History Month? How it's, you know, it's just like one month of the year, ironically the shortest month of the year, that's dedicated to Black history. And this is something Chimji said earlier, which I really like. She said a person isn't Black just one month of the year. That's a full year lived experience. So yeah, what does Black History Month mean to you? And yeah, what do you think is the how do you think, like, why do you think it's relevant? Why do you think it's important?
Okay, well, honestly, it's a bit strange because I found that after moving here, it took on a different meaning than what I'm used to. I'm from Jamaica and I've lived there all of my life, except for when I came up to UBC to pursue my studies. And in Jamaica, from a very young age, they, of course, made sure that I'd know the history of my country, the Caribbean in general. So naturally, I knew all the things that someone my age would be privy to. So Christopher Columbus, the slave trade, all of that. Mm-hmm. And that's normally what they would use to link up students who at our ages weren't exactly too involved in the politics and affairs of the world to something as important as Black History Month. So to me, it was always just kind of not necessarily a celebration, but a more cheerful acknowledgement of what we came from and who we were. But it kind of lacked all the depth of understanding that the issues that came of the origins of Black History Month had to begin with. So I never really saw Black History Month as something being relevant to, for example, rise of racial tensions mm-hmm. in North America or something. It was mm-hmm. just literally just a month where I'm Black, it's a Black History Month, we gotta appreciate things. Mm-hmm. But up here, where I was introduced to a place where I was not just part of the majority, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and honestly, that was a bit jarring, I realized that Black History Month meant all of that to me because being Black all of a sudden meant more. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it does make sense because I am out of my element now, so to speak. So actively noticing that I am Black mm-hmm. would lead to that, but I just found it extremely bizarre because even now, like as a person who's part of the Black Student Union, I realized that 2 or 3 years ago, I really wouldn't have cared enough to do anything. But now here I am in like UBC's first Black Student Union talking about Black History Month mm-hmm. because all of a sudden being Black matters.
Suddenly it's a role of activism and yeah. advocacy. Yeah.
So I think in summary, it basically just is a period of reflection. Mm-hmm. It's not a period mm-hmm. in my mind where we just celebrate or acknowledge Black people and leave it at that, because why wouldn't we be doing that all the time?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's a like set aside dedicated time to fully look at where one has come from, and not just one as an individual, as many people might think of themselves, but as a community, communities, countries, regions, all of that. Just look at all the things that have happened. So you never really forget the literal roots of your ancestry and all that, so that you can go on through the rest of the year, mm-hmm. up until next year, mm-hmm. with that in mind.
So, that's a really good, you basically, I guess, answer the question for all the other panelists. Sandra, what do you think?
Yes, I echo the same sentiments. Moving here from Nigeria myself, I realized that being Black was a topic of conversation all the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was definitely, when they talk about culture shock, that was really the only culture shock that I experienced moving from Nigeria to Canada. But I actually do enjoy Black History Month. I love that there's a dedicated month for it. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We all have dedicated times, weeks, months for different celebrations. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is the shortest month of the year. And yes, I will sign a petition to move it to summer. but I do like, because it brings a lot to our city. It brings a lot of entertainment. It brings out, you get to meet a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I get to be in conversations where I learn so much about Black history, Black present, and Black future. I think it is important to have that dedicated time to it. I think it is important to support Black local Black artists, mm-hmm. every day, mm-hmm. every month. Support Black-owned businesses. I think it's important to engage in these conversations whenever you can. However, having the set-aside time for it just brings more attention to, which was the original intention of Black History Month. Mm-hmm. It started as a week, mm-hmm. To learn about Black history at schools, and then it became a month. And I think it is doing what it needs to do, mm-hmm. and it's a very exciting time. It's actually my favorite month of the year. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Justifiably so. So I guess, obviously, we know that different things affect what's considered empowering, right? Mm-hmm. Race affects what's considered empowering. And I know that in my own country, what's considered empowering for a woman or a man is definitely very different, or would not necessarily be considered so if it's viewed through the lens of white, mm-hmm. Feminism, or like, mm-hmm. Eurocentric feminism. So I'm just curious, for you guys, what does a Black feminism look like, and how can we create space in intersectional feminism for Black feminism? Because feminism is not complete if it doesn't include Black feminism.
Mm-hmm. I do feel that Black feminism for me is a lot more intersectional than white feminism as we all know it. I think it includes all types of people, religions, class, abilities, race, I think sexes, genders, I think it includes all cultures. Mm-hmm. Like you said, what feminism looks like in Vancouver would not be the same way that feminism would look like in, for example, in Lagos. Mm-hmm. And that to me is having those conversations with people whose voices need to be heard, bringing queer, trans, Black folks and people of color to the table and having their voices heard first, voices of marginalized folks, that's how feminism becomes a lot more intersectional. And that, to me, is what Black feminism is all about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like, I would agree on that. As someone who, because in Jamaica, it's a bit harder to find yourself to be concerned with more political forms of activism. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm recently new to concepts such as feminism in its actuality. So mm-hmm.
That's fair.
So I wouldn't want to imply that my opinion is like fully developed or anything. But yeah. As someone who is recently or relevantly new to that, mm-hmm. I would kind of see feminism, well, Black feminism, as, well, see, the issue is there are so many different Black communities, like was mentioned before, and what's feminism in one place isn't considered the other.
There's no, like, Pan-African Black identity.
No.
Exactly. It's so
it's not a monolith.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I find it hard to make any statements that I would see as applying to all of it, but in general, mm-hmm. if I were to go about it, I would see in those communities, what is it that a Black man can do that they would not expect from a Black woman, that they would not want a Black woman to do, mm-hmm. or anything like that, or any other group apart from them. Mm-hmm. What is it that one certain group that seems to be dominant or in power has that they would not want others doing, even though there's no real reason not to. Mm-hmm. And from there, do it. Express it.
So you're basically, you're suggesting that it's pretty simple. It's like pretty rooted in the sense that just go out there and do what you're socially not expected to be able to do, right?
Yes.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and yeah, so I think, yeah, that's the whole point of intersectional feminism, right? You want to include as many identities as you possibly can because across cultures and racial identities, ideas and concepts about feminism are always going to be different. But we talk about intersectional feminism on this show a lot, but what I want to talk about today is I think Brandon is someone who I really want to ask this question from. So you grew up in Jamaica and you spent most so growing up in a majority in an African country, and then you come here, and how is that different for you as a black male? Do you think there's like a difference, and if so, like how?
That's a really interesting question, because I find myself thinking more and more about that, especially since I recently joined the Black Student Union at UBC, so you know, being black has become a very frequent topic. I noticed that I was always acutely aware that I was black. I don't remember if I said it earlier, but I know a lot of people will always say that, hey, when I was in this country, I didn't feel black. I just felt this nationality or whatever. But when I came here, that's when I noticed my blackness. But I found that I always knew I was black. I always knew about the certain issues that there might have been, any like racial relations, like negative racial relations and all that. I intrinsically understood that as someone who in literally like grade 2 was already learning about slave trades and all mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. and the roots behind like Black History Month. Mm-hmm. But it never seemed to matter when I was in a group of mainly black people. Mm-hmm. And even though I went to a private school, so mm-hmm. there are a lot of international people there too. Mm-hmm. Just being in Jamaica, the culture, since they all follow the same culture, I associated all of that with being black, and as such, I always felt black. And with never needing to worry about how other people feel I am in terms of my race or what they think that means, because we all kind of had the same consensus, mm-hmm. it just... it didn't matter. But I come up here and it's noticeable. People will joke around and it's like, oh, you're black. Let me hear you drop some bars or something like that.
That's really strange.
it's black. Or that.
Also, Brandon, guys, I don't mean to interrupt you, but Sydney, she's finally made it to our studio. The taxi took a long time. Thank you for being here.
It didn't show up, but you know.
Oh, man.
But hey, thank you for being here. And just to give you some context, we're talking about black masculinity and how black feminism informs ideas of black masculinity. That's what Brandon was just giving us a little rundown on, if you will.
Wow.
But yeah.
Do you feel like there are certain, and Danielle, maybe you're more suited to answer the question, but do you feel like there are certain stereotypes or certain things that you're expected to do or behave as a black man specifically?
Yeah, definitely. There are.
Apart from dropping a few bars.
Yeah. People expect a lot of more openly, it's supposed to be interpreted as strength in that, for example, if they insult me or something like that, I'm not supposed to care. And it's not supposed to matter. If anything, I'm supposed to have a comeback just like that, that's swift, that's worse than anything that I said. And I'm supposed to be kind of calm in my approach, but methodical. I'm supposed to know how to do all of these things when it comes to relations to make myself seem cool, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. it seems as if black people, black men, being mm-hmm. cool is kind of the most generalized understanding people who have never really interacted with them have, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess, thanks to things like hip-hop. Mm-hmm. And also, they expect me to just, like, generally just be a man, mm-hmm. but like in the most manliest of ways,
right.
And I find that absolutely ridiculous because I'm one of the like softest, most emotional, adorable people I've ever met. So,
I love that.
Now there's a lesson for self-confidence.
Like, I'm definitely nowhere close to the black man people expect from me,
right?
And at the same time, I have to give people credit. Once they realize that, you know, that's just an an error in their thinking. They don't hold it against me or anything. But the fact that they have that preconceived notion is what I find to be the most like jarring thing about being a black man and the expectations surrounding it.
Right, right. And, oh, sorry, go ahead, Danielle.
And that's the thing, right? Like, you never notice these preconceived notions about your identity when you're living in your own country. Mm-hmm. You only get to notice them when you're interacting with someone from a completely different country and culture who does not know your culture that well, and they have these preconceived notions and ideas about what a black male should be like. So, as you said, you are expected to have these witty comebacks all the time, and you're supposed to be cool, which I'm not particularly sure what it means. But and I'm pretty sure they don't even know what they mean, what it means. But they just know it's a thing. It's this idea in their head. So yeah, that's just super interesting at how you never notice these things when you're living in your own country, but when you come to someplace else, it just hits you all the time, and you're always thinking about it.
No, that's a good point. And we're all in, I mean, we're all in Vancouver now, and there are many underrepresented minorities in BC, obviously. And I'm always curious about the interactions between different minorities, because a lot of times you hear a lot of conversation about, like, it's like kind of pits like, oh, white people versus people of color. And as I think that this is probably, I shouldn't say this on air, but I think that in my own community, there's a lot of racism towards other minorities, which is ridiculous, because it's like, y'all, we got to like stick together. And I guess like having said that, how do you think we can, actually, no, I feel like you're better suited to that. We were talking about this earlier about, do you want to take this question, Chimji?
Okay. Wait, what was your question?
We were talking about, kind of like with Southeast Asian minorities interacting with the black community.
Yeah, there's been so many conversations where I've just been talking to like another Asian person, whether they're Southeast, East, or just South Asian, and suddenly they drop the N-word, and then I'm sitting there like, no. And I want to, like, my basic instinct is to say, no, you can't say that. But then at the same time, I'm like, how do I have the place to say that? So I guess what my question is like, is it just the responsibility of that particular community to police like certain words, or do all communities play a role in that responsibility as well, especially if they have somewhat of an understanding?
Well, it's interesting you brought up that specific example, because I grew up in a city called Brampton in Ontario.
You mean Browntown?
Leave us alone. So, I think over the course of my my 20 years in Brampton, in Browntown, it was like, if you look at my like grade one yearbook pictures up until maybe like the 12th grade, you can visibly see the integration and the migration of largely people from the Punjab region who came to Brampton, and you can see kind of, for lack of a better word, the white flight. And how the pictures change over the years. So I had a very interesting relationship with, like, a lot of my, I don't know how else to say this. A lot of my friends are Punjabi. A lot of my friends are Indian.
That's a totally fair statement.
It's like saying, like, some of my best friends are white. It's like, I don't know how to say it without being like, ugh. But basically, like, I think that to answer your question, I've had to interact with people who think that they can say the N-word, or people who think that they're black, in all the ways that are very convenient for them, and in none of the ways that are inconvenient for them. And so, in that upbringing and having those people not just be in my space, but being my friends, I think that there's a level of I don't want to say responsibility, because I don't think that it's necessarily one minority's job to educate another minority. I think that's a lot of emotional labor. I think it's a lot of onus on them to constantly be educating people while they themselves have to educate themselves. Because no one is coming and telling me, this is how you interact with so-and-so, this is how you interact with so-and-so. Because in a lot of different situations, and I only realized this living in that city and then going to different places in the world, black people are very often at the bottom of this racial hierarchy. So we're constantly the people who have to educate other people. And it's never kind of done the other way around. And I think to a degree, that's something that we should be able to embrace and we should do. But I think a lot of the onus is within the community. And if that's your friend, if you're my friend, then you need to talk to your friends. Then you need to talk to your mother. You need to tell your mother not to call me this, that, and the third when I come to your house. Like these, and that's, of course, an extreme example. But those are the things that I think it's a matter of finding that balance between saying you're my friend and because I want a relationship with you, this is what the emotional labor that I'm willing to put in. But because you're my friend, you want a relationship with me. This is the this is your job as well, if mm-hmm. that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with everything you said. I also think it's part of one's work as an ally. So it would be a lot easier for you, I think, emotionally to say, hey, I actually don't appreciate when you use the N-word around me. I know that, that's not really my lived experience or my history, but it makes me uncomfortable. Than it would be for me to say that to your friend. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's different emotional labor for you. That separation from that history makes it a lot easier for you to speak up. And the same way I will speak up for my friends if they're experiencing something that they're directly connected to. Mm-hmm. I think it's all of our work. It's all of our responsibility. I have met people that think it's okay to say the N-word because their other Black friend told them it was okay to say the N-word.
Or their favorite rapper says it.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, well, we sing about it. So why can't we, why can't I say it? And
Did
I heard
Post Malone
this,
say it? Because that guy's white as they come.
I don't think so, really, actually. Yeah. I don't think so. But... I heard this once at a talk. I go to this Women of Color talks in Vancouver, which is amazing. And someone had said, think of it like a gift card to one store. So if you have a friend that allows you to say certain things that generally is just offensive, then you've gotten a gift card to that store. This gift card does not apply to all stores in the mall. So you should not assume that because this one friend said it's okay to say something, then every Black person walking the face of the earth should be okay with it. It's just not the way it is.
Amen.
Yeah. One person doesn't speak for everybody. Yeah.
And will never.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's I think the N-word specifically is so contentious, especially when you look at the, like in context of like hip hop and rap culture. I think the appropriation of Black culture has become so much more insidious now because mm-hmm. it's kind of like rap and hip hop is probably one of if not the most lucrative and popular genre. So all of a sudden mm-hmm. it's like, oh, it's like acceptable, it's cool. So then it just becomes like a gray area. Mm-hmm. Like, when are you appropriating? When are you just being straight up disrespectful? And when are you just kind of, I don't know, enjoying the culture or appreciating mm-hmm. the culture? So to me, it's definitely a very gray area.
Also, and I'm kind of curious about this as well. So we see a lot of that word particularly used in a lot of pop culture videos and like music videos, or it's going to be on social media. And then as a Black person, because it's mostly Black people referring to other Black people mm-hmm. in a really casual way. But then again, you just said that one person doesn't speak for everyone. But how does that make you feel as people from that community? Do you feel like it's okay, or do you still take somewhat kind of like offense to it, or in a way? Like, I'm just curious to know about that.
So I didn't grow up using the N-word. I knew about it. I knew the history, but it was never something that was in my vocabulary or any of my friends. I still till today don't say it, even when it's in songs. Sometimes, you know, I get ahead of myself, but it's not the ways that I address my loved ones, in case you're wondering.
No, I just want to be clear.
No,
that's not what I meant.
No, absolutely. I'm just
Danielle's like panicking. It's like,
I'm so sorry if
no,
I came
I'm
off
kidding.
That way.
No, I don't. I don't care that other Black people use it. I don't care at all. I think it's a way of taking a hold of that word and stripping it of its past, of the power that it used to have. And now it's like, you know what? It's ours now mm-hmm. and no one else can say. And I actually really love that.
Yeah, it's empowering.
It's
now, right?
Very empowering. And it's also transforming the meaning of that word in itself. The mm-hmm. history is still always going to be mm-hmm. there, and that would never change. And no, mm-hmm. we're never going to get over it. Mm-hmm. However, the present and the ways that it's used, it's kind of changed the effects that it has on people. So using it casually amongst Black folks, to me, it's okay. None of my Black friends say that to me. None of, like, no one else calls me that word, just because it's not something that the group and the circle that I am in, we use. But if I am in a space where someone says it to each other, that's fine. But if I am addressed that way, I always say, oh, actually, I don't respond to that. But thank you. I mean, I guess that's friendly for you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, on that note, let's just take a little break. It's getting a little intense, and I don't want our readers to just be like, okay, whoa. All right, guys, stay tuned. You're listening to Intersections at CITR Radio at 101.9 FM. We'll be back after this short break.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
I was a prisoner.
Cocaine addiction.
Cocaine took my drink. It made me lie, steal.
Cocaine took my will, my soul.
And all I wanted was more cocaine. Cocaine Anonymous gave me freedom and saved my life. If you got a problem with cocaine, pick up the phone. We're here to help.
Contact Cocaine Anonymous toll-free by calling 866-662-8300 or find them online at ca-bc.ca.
Thanks to sky-high gas prices, we can convince America that more drilling is the answer. High gas prices? Drill more. Prices still high? Try drilling in a wildlife refuge or off a nice beach.
Our traditional energy resources are limited. Luckily, it's easy for students like you to conserve energy.
Woke up late for class? Buy some time in the morning by taking a shorter shower. Cut down by 1 minute every day and save enough to fund your daily caffeine fix for over a week. Plus, you save on electricity and water. Install a water-saving showerhead to save even more.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Hello again, everyone. You're listening to Intersections at 101.9 FM. And right now, we're in the studio with our panelists, Brandon, Sydney, and Sandra. And our show's about Black history and Black excellence. So that's what's going on right now, in case you guys have just tuned in and you're like, what the heck is happening? Are we allowed to say heck on air? Okay, whatever.
Okay, so there's something that I've kind of noticed in the media and just like with certain groups of people that I speak to. There's this idea that because the United States has been publicized to have more of a race problem, and that you see these types of items being brought to our attention more in the media from the U.S., there's this kind of notion that Canada isn't dealing with the same thing, and that Canada in comparison is fine. That racism is something that our neighbors engage in, but we not so much. So there's this kind of like idea that maybe like outcries of like anti-Black racism here aren't as like justified just in comparison, but like have you ever received this type of attitude, like just comparing the two countries together?
Yeah, like the whole Canada is so much more nicer.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the big preconceived notions about America and Canada is that Canada is a lot more European than America is. And I think if you've ever been to Europe, you you understand that they have their own very interesting breed of racism that also exists there. I think, well, we have to remember one thing. Canada is about 10% of the U.S.'s population. Mm-hmm. So everything that Canada faces, the U.S. faces just at an inflated rate.
Yeah.
So it's not so much that, like, our history is very similar. Mm-hmm. We both had a history of slavery. We both had a history of Indigenous genocide. There was the same migration, for lack of a better word, from Europe, fleeing religious prosecution, seeking the new world, all that. Like, it's a very, very paralleled coming of age. I think the few differences are just the way that Canada has publicized itself. Canada has much better PR than America does.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that's a big part of why people can say something like Canada's post-racial racism doesn't exist, or even there are no Black people in Canada, and get away with it.
Yeah.
Because it's not as obvious. I think from being from Ontario, there's a larger black population there. So we have a bitter, a slightly more proportionate understanding of how Canada interacts with blackness. There's police brutality there, just like there's police brutality everywhere else. Everywhere else where the police brutality exists. But I mean, the issues that you see and the idea that racism doesn't exist, it's harder to ignore in places where black people are, first of all, in community. I think especially in BC, Vancouver specifically, there are a lot of black people here, but we're very fragmented. So there's not a community center. There aren't neighborhoods. There aren't areas where you can see us in groups of, I don't know, how many of us are in this room? Three. So I think that's a big part of it. I think all of us can attest to our personal experiences with racism here, back home, even if it's not racism, if it's colorism, if it's different things that spawn from that same idea of white supremacy. I don't think that you can ever escape that. I think a lot of it is just the fact that we're smaller and the fact that we're spread out, it makes it very easy to erase blackness and interactions with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Honestly, I very much agree with that. And actually, interestingly enough, in my first year, I have not fact-checked this, though I've heard from many people that it's true. But basically, all the things that people would stereotypically fear about how America treats black people, such as their arrest rates and so on, tend to actually be more or less the same, if not similar, in Canada. And while I like I said, I personally haven't actually looked too deep into that. I'm not trying to be around anywhere where police are, because I shouldn't be anywhere where police are if they're on duty. Mm-hmm. But I've never gotten the feeling that Canada is somehow so much better for black people than America. What I have gotten a sense of is that black people are so spread out. They're literally everywhere, and I barely ever see one, to the point where interactions of them must be so far and few between, well, far and wide between, like, everyone here, that they kind of just start to think that they're better. And it's very noticeable to me, especially when I'm here, because I've met a lot of domestic students from high schools in Vancouver and, like, surrounding areas. And suspiciously enough, the first thing they'll tell me is that, wow, you're like the first black person that I actually like met. Like, I mean, maybe I see black people, but I know you.
I see black people.
Yeah. And I get that so much, to the point where it really kind of just sticks in my head that, you know, not that many people, or I don't want to say that my anecdotal like experience is reflective of a whole, but it still seems like a decent amount of people aren't actually getting to interact with black people or communities of them enough to make an actual proper opinion on how better or worse Canada might be. But it seems to be the same to me.
Yeah, and that's a really good point you make about interaction. It kind of ties into what Sydney was saying earlier about like white supremacy. Because like on the flip side, if you think of white fragility, like in my own experience, I feel like especially as a journalism student, there's always this like these workshops and these conversations about like diversity and representation and how we have to be open and supportive of people from all walks of life and colors and genders and all that stuff. But when push comes to shove, and you have an actual situation that requires you to have uncomfortable conversations, all of a sudden, like, no one's in sight. It's just me and a couple other people of color looking around like, where did all the supportive, liberal, you know, woke white people go?
And all the white people feel attacked.
Yeah. So, like, how do you navigate that space where it's like, hey, man, like, I appreciate that we have this month to celebrate our culture, and I appreciate that we are having these workshops and these, like, little diversity sessions, but it's not going to work if you don't step forward when you need to. Mm-hmm. Even at the risk of your own, like, community, right? Oh,
just
swinging our mics, guys. We have a little mic shortage in the studio.
Just very quickly, what I do is I swim right through white tears. That's sunstroke.
Hey!
That's sunstroke. That's it takes practice, but if you work on the arm movements, work on the legs, flutter kicks, you'll get there.
You gotta have that core. You gotta have that core.
There we go.
I'm gonna rename the show to Swim Through the White Tears.
It's hard. It honestly is hard to navigate that situation. It's hard being in that situation. A lot of the work falls back on the person of color or the marginalized person or the person that brings forward the issue to figure it out or to move on or to work on it, a lot of bureaucracy comes into play. A lot of people say, oh, well, this is not a racial issue, you know? First of all, you have to prove that it's a racial issue, and then maybe something will come out of it. So it is exhausting. It's not impossible. It just, it takes a lot of strategy. I find that you have to almost play the same game, but know your end goal. So you have to meet bureaucracy or speak their language, I should say, when it comes to navigating those issues and having them being heard and taking them seriously. You have to speak almost the same language, or meet them where they are, where they're at, for them to actually understand. And I find that sometimes it's helpful to have an ally. If I am experiencing something at work, I will go talk to another white person that has done the work, and they know where I'm coming from. And I express to them, this is what I'm going through. They're not listening to me. They're not hearing me. I need this to be taken care of. And for some reason, I mean, I don't know why, but when another white person says the same thing I'm saying, it's just heard clearer. That tends to
Then it's
work.
Flagged, right?
Yeah.
This is an issue now.
It's an issue now.
So honestly, like, I agree with both. And being, I partially vaguely fit the, like, stereotypical caricature of like a black manly man that I had mentioned before, in that when it comes to many, many, many things, I am extremely apathetic. I'm chilled to my core. So, and I'm extremely social too. So I found it a very strange thing, because being social means that I have to be someone who appeals to as many people as I can.
Yeah.
And a lot of people here, in the wake of people being like stronger political advocates for things like this, tend to instantly make these assumptions. They have a group of assumptions once you seem to even somewhat care about like certain topics. And naturally for me, I cared about those topics because, hey, I have to do with some of them. But at the same time, hey, I want to get to know you. I want to befriend you and so on. I want to befriend everyone I meet and make them feel comfortable around me. So at first, I was trying to see how I could just avoid it, especially when it came to white people, because people seem to think that white's just the polar opposite and, like, enemy of black, as if no other group could be issues. But I think, to be honest, white people themselves also tend to feel like that. And I realized, when it comes to these things, their lack of understanding and sometimes the resistance to what people say and all of those things, I don't want to generalize, but from what I've seen, it's because they don't see themselves as a villain or a negative. They don't want to be seen as that. And they genuinely think that they're being villainized and being villainized for something that they aren't doing. Or they're being said they're wrong for something they think's right. And when you have that kind of mindset, it's very hard for anyone who doesn't understand that to actually go and say anything to you, because you're instantly thinking, hey, this person sees me as like the villain, the opponent, and they're just trying to call me wrong and change me. So I realized, when it comes to navigating these kinds of issues with white people, or any people, because it's not just white people, you kind of have to approach them as a person. And I'm not saying, like, a lot of people don't, but a lot of people have the opinion that I'll just, like, jump down your throat and strangle you. But, like, just have a talk. Like, don't allow them to think that you're trying to come off as someone policing them, telling them what to do, or that you're going there to say, you're wrong, I'm right, or anything. Just talk about what you feel, why you feel that way, and how that kind of behavior tends to make similar people to you feel. Right. And most reasonable people, in a matter of feelings and just knowledge and understanding, will see that, understand that, and respect it. They might not agree with you. I know several people who think they can say the N-word whenever they want. And yet around me, they still wouldn't. Not because they think they shouldn't, but because they understand that it's a matter of respect. And I think even in a world where every single white person, Indian person, Asian person, anyone thinks they should say it, Mm-hmm. If they don't, out mm-hmm. of respect, that's just as well. Like,
yeah.
that's still partially the goal.
That's a step forward. Yeah. yeah. And I, what you said really speaks to me, because I've been in several social situations where there's like this kind of like slightly, like, I guess no pun intended, like this offbeat joke or like off-color joke that was like, I was like, should I just, you know, play along and kind of mm-hmm. laugh and kind of just let this go? Or should I stand up and make this a scene? Mm-hmm. Right? So I think, yeah, it's definitely a kind of a fine line between advocacy and especially in social situations.
Yeah, I feel like there's a big problem with having like using divisive language initially and then going from there, because as soon as you call somebody a racist, they're not mm-hmm. listening to you anymore.
Yeah.
They're just trying to defend themselves mm-hmm. and like separate themselves from the label as much as they possibly can. And I think especially with like the way social media is now, like on Twitter and everything like that, that call labeling people things and then writing them off is so easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to bring up. So our last show, we did talk about cancel culture, about people who have said or done problematic things or like once it comes out, they're canceled. You know, you can't support them or their endeavors anymore, or you're, you know, a part of their camps, right? So do you think that like in this like Twitter scene or like just in the media in general, that people belonging to minority groups are disproportionately like scrutinized when it comes to whatever their like their actions on the internet, or like are people like gunning for like prominent like ethnic figures, right?
Is anyone else thinking of Kevin Hart or
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Oh boy. Go ahead.
I think that people that belong to a minority group or marginalized folks have always been scrutinized.
Mm,
that's just for the foreseeable future, that is what it's going to be. I do think that I hold black folks a lot differently than I hold white folks.
Mm-hmm.
I hold people of color a lot differently than I would hold white folks. Just because we're all trying to heal and move forward from white supremacy and colonization, right? And so, with that said, the ways that I address problematic people of color on Twitter or Facebook, whatever, is going to be different from the way that I address problematic people on that are white on social media. Would I still support someone that has said something that is you know, horrible or insensitive or ignorant or racist, that is a person of color, a black person? No, I will still be just as hurt by their comment as if a white person said it. However, that the process of moving past that and healing and coming together as community looks a lot different for me. Yeah.
I kind of have a similar take, because as someone, again, like, I'm studying psychology. I want to be a therapist. I love being involved with people. Like, I make year groups on Facebook. I try every literal thing I can do to, like, be part of communities and interact with people. I know this isn't necessarily a popular opinion, and I understand why people disagree with me, but I, for one, utterly hate cancel culture and things relating to it
mm-hmm.
for people that have actually changed.
Yeah.
Because
again, Kevin Hart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Kevin
Sorry,
Hart
I really feel strongly about that one. Anyway, continue, Brandon. Sorry for interrupting you.
But that's a good one, because the Kevin
Hart
thing.
I really do want to talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one really annoyed me, because like I was a fan of Kevin Hart like way back when, even when he made some of the jokes that people mm-hmm. really like reamed him out for and stuff. And I was there, and like, as a member of the groups he was also making fun of, while also being a black person, he was like, oh my god, a famous black person. I was like, And even young Brandon, I took a step back, and I understood that at the time there was nothing wrong with doing that, because not that many people were speaking up about it yet, mm-hmm. to the point where everyone understood
mm-hmm.
why.
Mm-hmm.
And while those things were wild of him to say, I knew he also didn't actually believe those sentiments or share them.
Mm-hmm.
He had the typical fear that a lot of people in black communities have when it comes to like LGBT plus children
mm-hmm.
in their communities, because a lot of people don't know how to deal with that because they've never had the education surrounding that. And all of that was, I could understand it. And partially being a black person as well helped me to see his perspective. And in general, I think because humans tend to operates based on like heuristics, like mental shortcuts and groups. And when you combine that, you just make a lot of assumptions about groups that you think you know, mm-hmm. even when you know that everyone can be different. Mm-hmm. And so same group people, like light groups, it's just easier to expect different, think differently, and relate differently, mm-hmm. whether that be easier or harder. And with that, people have different levels of understanding that they would attribute to a situation, mm-hmm. especially if you're more invested. Like, I, as a black person, if I see another black person do something which I think is completely whack, I'm definitely going to care more about that and, mm-hmm. like, be more like, why? Why would you do this? And all of yeah. that than, let's say, any other person. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's particularly good, though, because, like I said, I hate cancel culture for people of change, and I think that we should all take the same amount of time to understand why people did X in the past or mm-hmm. doing it now.
Mm-hmm. Context is key.
Context yeah. is key. And whether or not they understand why people mm-hmm. would prefer they not do it mm-hmm. and how considerate they're being, mm-hmm. even at the end of the day, if they choose not to care mm-hmm. about like the issues, if they consider it, if they actually show why they understand what mm-hmm. you're saying and disagree mm-hmm. and it's a personal matter of like opinion, mm-hmm. when they make effort to be better, especially when they're taking into account what you say, mm-hmm. to just go ahead and then still entirely nullify their existence, nullify the change they're making because of other people, for other people, mm-hmm. I very much can't get behind that, because in my mind, a community is full of people who respect each other, mm-hmm. not necessarily mm-hmm. agree with each other. Mm-hmm. And if someone's going to take the time to respect you and try their best to continuously respect you mm-hmm. and change and be mm-hmm. better and do better, mm-hmm. I think you should treat them as new people, yeah. not just the same old.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. the thing is, they aren't the same old.
Yeah, and people change so much, like, in a single so year. Much. And Kevin Hart changed a lot over 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. So
everyone has changed a lot over 10 years. I mean, a lot of people were very ignorant and uninformed then.
Yeah.
I do understand the hurt that people are coming from, because some of the things that were said and brought to light are very hurtful things. And they're also people's realities, too, which is why it's hurtful. So while I understand that, I don't necessarily... Cancel culture is kind of like sheep mentality, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily think that everyone should be canceled, especially not because of something that was done 10 years ago. But I do think that demanding and seeking for true change in their actions, I keep telling people, change behavior is the best apology. Mm-hmm. And so if someone is going to apologize for something, then you have to follow it with your actions. And I think that's really all we can ask for.
That's it. I agree, yeah.
I just wanted to say, I agree with everything that's been said, and I'm really glad you guys put it that way. It's funny that you, I'm glad that you did, because I came at the question in a different way. Mm-hmm. When you said cancel culture, I immediately thought of Black Twitter. Oh. And let me tell you something right now. We are quick. We were with the quickness. We will listen. I don't know how many times, like, even just this year, and it's what, February, end of February, I've seen like Black Twitter, do your thing. And we will find your job. We will find your mama's house. We will find your daddy's house. Oh, they will lose their job. Listen, you will lose your life insurance policy. All of a sudden, your car is getting repossessed. I think that, and I have a problem with that on different levels. I have a problem with cancel culture in general, because I think that, like you guys were saying, it nullifies people who evolve. Mm-hmm. Evolution is part of the human experience. I think it's also hypocritical because it's so selective. Mm-hmm. I think we're very quick to cancel some people and slow to cancel others.
Yes.
I think that double standard, even within the Black community, I think that's something that we need to be critical of in and of ourselves. You have examples like Bill Cosby. And that could be a whole episode on in and of itself, by itself. You have mm-hmm. people who, even recently, the Jussie Smollett case, mm-hmm. where people were very, very vocal in the beginning. And now it's like, maybe I'll just sit back. Maybe I just won't say anything now. Maybe I'll just hold my tongue. And it happens too often to be something that we just accept and move on with. I mean, sure, you have the people who need to be canceled. You have, for example, Bill Cosby needs to be canceled. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Mm-hmm. sorry. It's a very...
Sorry, not sorry.
Sorry, not sorry. It's a very controversial opinion. I might have to watch my back when I'm kidding. But, like, they're... Yes. louder. I mean, even there are regular everyday people who are captured on video doing things that they would have done, that they're doing on video. So imagine what they're doing off video. Those people need to be canceled. I mean, and to be canceled, I mean, not, I don't like saying that word. I mean, they need to be held accountable for their actions in real life.
Yes.
That is what needs to happen. I think this idea of, oh, now they're canceled. Now Gucci's canceled. You're just talking about on the phone. Now everybody's canceled. It's like, I think that.
Now Gillette is canceled.
Yeah, everyone, listen, canceled. No more deodorant. We're just going to. But I think that there needs to be, in some ways it is, but in many ways, the internet, social media, it's not real life. I think there need to be, like I said before, real world, tangible, real and tangible methods of accountability being held. I think it needs to be consistent. Mm-hmm. I think that we can't protect some people because we like them, and I think we can't not protect some people because we don't like them. Mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. it needs to be, as much as I am all for the court of public opinion, I think it needs to be a lot more balanced.
Mm-hmm. Can I say something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, and that, honestly, getting into that really reminds me of an issue that literally every single person who has like any device ever knows, which is the fact that now more than ever, we're more connected. People say that every single second of every single day. We all know it. Yeah, blah, blah, blah. We have internet now, whatever. But people are more connected. But they don't understand what that really means when it comes to the situations like this that affect people and how people feel and what matters to people. Mm-hmm. All these situations, all these issues have to do with empathy and things relating to that. It's not some like logical, easily, like, it's not something you can really just cut and divide and be like, this is it. It's not clear cut at all. Mm-hmm. It has to do with people, and people are finicky. People are delicate. Some people aren't. Some people are strong. Some people aren't. And the whole point of society is to find a balance. Mm-hmm. Now, when we're in a society that is like basically the world, mm-hmm. when the society is your whole planet, mm-hmm. and everyone has a say, mm-hmm. and everyone has something that bothers them, and people bring up these issues, people tend to act as if it's a bad thing that people are bringing up issues now, it's a mm-hmm. bad thing that people are being affected, when in reality, this is just what happens when you have a community. People care about things, and you should always be striving to find a way to have the most respect for the most amount of people, if not everyone, ideally everyone.
Now, we unfortunately don't have a lot of time left. We have, I think, exactly 5 or 6 minutes left. And before we go, I really wanted to ask you guys this. You know, we talked a lot about how your identity as a Black person is kind of even more cemented after when you're in a really white space, right? Like you're really hyper-conscious, hyper-aware. And you know, Brandon, Sydney, you both are part of UBC's Black Student Union. And Sandra, you're part of Black Lives Matter, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious about how do you guys take care of yourselves, like your mental health when you're dealing with these kinds of topics on either like an almost daily basis. And when I say daily basis, I mean like in terms of activism, right? How do you deal with your own mental health? Do you ever feel like you just don't want to be accountable all the time for your community? And sometimes, hey, you're just Sandra. Mm-hmm. Like you're not, you know, an activist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of the times I'm just Sandra. In a lot of spaces that people see me, I'm not in activist mode. Mm-hmm. But I also go to counseling. Mm-hmm. I think that's something I really advocate for. I think everyone should have access to that. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should have more sliding scale counseling services available. I let my friends take care of me. I take time off. I literally disconnect and stay in my studio and do nothing else. But for the most part, I will say just having your friends, your family hold you and take care of you, letting them know where you are, just speaking up about how you are, how you're doing. If you're exhausted, drained, depressed, whatever the case may be, just speaking up about that and letting people hold you in the ways that they can and support you, that's the biggest part. Mm-hmm. And also speaking with my counselor about a lot of things is also very helpful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting... I'm really glad you said that. You advocated for counseling and therapy. I think those are very important things that... It's interesting because I think Black people, and I'm generalizing here, we face some of the most emotionally traumatizing situations, not even in our own existence, but generationally, because mm-hmm. I believe that you carry traumas from your ancestors. And at the same time, we have some of the strongest stigma in our own community about mental health. Mm-hmm. I think in all of our families, there's that one or two aunt or uncle who we know is off. We don't ever address it. Mm-hmm. We just kind of let them do their own thing in the corner, mm-hmm. as destructive as it may be. So I think that, first of all, trying to deconstruct that is an important part. I think a lot of us who are activists, Blacktivists, and who are taking on a lot of daily emotional labor, I think the first step is acknowledging that that's happening to you. Mm-hmm. Acknowledging that you are putting in a different type of work and that you need to make sure that you are constantly checking in with yourself. Like you said, letting your friends take care of you. I think that's so important. I think being vulnerable and even speaking to Black masculinity, even Black femininity, we don't necessarily allow ourselves to be vulnerable, to be human, mm-hmm. to exactly the Black strong woman and the Black strong man and the stoicism, mm-hmm. and the constant togetherness. I think that just stepping back from that, even temporarily, does wonders for your mental health, for your stress levels, for emotional well-being, for your lifespan. Definitely doing that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have exactly a minute left. So do you have any really quick words, Brandon? And then I can see Melanie, she's waiting outside, about to come in.
Okay, well, I mean,
quick words, Brandon.
as someone who wants to BSU, like, came about, mm-hmm. spends literally like every hour wondering, hey, when are people gonna see this and like try and have us removed yet? When are people gonna be like, BSU? What about WSU and stuff?
Yeah.
I find that it is a bit stressful sometimes to be putting yourself out there, mm-hmm. but I seem to be lucky in that I don't really suffer from most of the same issues from most activists, mm-hmm. because I don't represent my ideas with groups. Normally, mm-hmm. it's me by my lonesome, mm-hmm. and being separated from, like, let's say a Black Lives Matter banner, mm-hmm. where a lot of people may have different ideas or understandings of it, but they're all under one banner, so people find it so easy to simplify what they're going for and mm-hmm. try and attack them. When people, like, go with me one-on-one, mm-hmm. it's far easier because people mostly want to be reasonable.
Yeah.
I tend to, like, subsequently get less stress from the entire thing. So
right.
It's just really a balance of when I actually want to go out and, like, bother talking to people or not.
That's fair. All right, guys, honestly, I would love to stay here and have this conversation for another hour, but we can't. Sandra, Sydney, and Brandon, thank you so much for being here. And, of course, Danielle and Jimji, thank you for being here, too. All right, guys, you were listening to Intersections at CITR 101.9. Thank you, guys. Drive home safe and be kind to one another. All right, take care, everyone. Bye now.
Bye.
Hi, my name's Matthew. When I first got back from a military tour in Afghanistan, any time I heard a siren or even a car alarm, I'd lose it completely.